starting my clock at 6:15, so we're going to open the meeting, Eugene Water and Electric Board, on November 5th, 2019. And we will start off with a quick agenda check. Nope. All right. Items from commissioners and general manager. We'll start down here.
Yeah, just several items. I got, again, to give, I had a couple of kids in my two wards win the poster presentation. It's always one of the funnest things to do, going to the fifth graders and have them explain what they did on coloring contests. And again, a great group of engaged kids and fun to watch. And they really are excited about what we do, but it educates them about electricity and things. And thank you again to staff and everybody that took care of that. I also want to know that in November 2017, we adopted a strategic plan for protecting the McKenzie watershed, and we budgeted about, we allocated about $5.6 million. I was wondering if I could maybe get a couple head nods to sometimes get a report or just a feedback on that, where we are and where we are in the program and the process and things such as that, because I kind of want to follow up on that.
President Carlson, we have an update scheduled on the drinking water source protection program for March of next year. Is that
okay? Okay. Yeah, that's fine. I'm just, it's a significant amount of money compared to what we've spent right. in the past. I just kind of want to see where our money's going and what we're doing and how the septic programs and things
yep.
are going.
It'll be that. A full program update.
Okay, thank you. And lastly, I'd just like to acknowledge Mr. former Commissioner Simpson in the crowd today. We sat next to him for 8 years. I was going to say I'd offer you the seat here, but I think I'd get in trouble. But welcome back, John.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, welcome. Thank you for coming out. Commissioner
Helgeson,
I'll go last.
I don't have a lot to report. I did make another trip to California, and it's an interesting place to go with wildfires and power outages and, you know, challenges having to do with the integration of solar and renewables, and something interesting to be reminded of and to watch in context of strategic direction for our utility. And other than that, I think I will pass to my fellow Commissioner Mindy.
I had a busy EWEB month. I went to the Community Vitality and Natural Hazards Workshop, and then also went to the follow-up resiliency workshop. I went to O'Hara to present the winners there, and that was really fun, and I was accompanied by Jen Connors. I went to Eugene 350 had a carbon challenge workshop. I went to that as well. And lastly, we had our first joint meeting with the city to talk about how we can start coordinating over climate. It's been a long time in the making to have that meeting finally come about. And so it was a great first start.
Good. All right. Okay, I'll wrap it up. I also attended a number of the same meetings. The Community Vitality Workshop, I did not get to go to the Resiliency Workshop. I also was very honored to be able to present the award at El Camino del Rio for a fifth grader there with the Public Power Week, the poster contest. So fun to go into the schools and actually see the kids and see what they're thinking about and how they grapple with electricity. And then met with the leadership group with the City of Eugene to talk about various topics of particular interest to both parties. So great first step. Look forward to this group continuing to engage more with the city directly and building that relationship. I don't think that meeting is, the next meeting is scheduled in January, so I won't be a part of that. Whoever the next president will be there, but it was a great meeting. And we'll end with Frank.
Thank you, President Carlson. I like the board, have spent quite a bit of time over the last few months doing quite a bit of outreach, primarily having to do with environment, power supply, electrification, carbon. I met with everybody from the City of Eugene to the governor's office to a number of different environmental groups. That's a hot topic for the region. It's timely because we are working on our integrated resource plan, and so spent quite a bit of my time specifically on power supply the last month or so.
Okay. Great. Well, I think We're finished with items from commissioners and general manager, and look at that, we're at 6:20. So we will move on to public input. I will first do a facility awareness and safety briefing. So if there are any folks that want to sign up to give public testimony, please. Is the table, it's still outside, okay. Please give that to Holly. And all of the visitors, you can only access the first floor of the building. The restrooms are down this hallway, all the end, and to the left. And if there's any sort of emergency, the exits are here and here. And finally, if for some reason we need to leave, the gathering point is out in the parking lot at the flagpoles. So, while giving public input, please state your name and optionally your address and speak firmly towards the microphone. Each speaker will be offered 3 minutes to present their testimony. Our standing secretary, Holly, will be able to keep time, and please see the presentation screen here, which will indicate your time remaining. A chime will sound when you have 30 seconds remaining, followed by a series of beeps when your time has elapsed. After all testimony is heard, each commissioner will have an opportunity to speak if they choose, although by policy we do not engage in a back-and-forth dialogue. Please note that failure of a commissioner to speak shall not be construed as support of or opposition to any speaker's testimony. If a question is presented by a speaker and the board does not provide an answer, an eWeb staff member will contact the speaker so that the question can be addressed at a later time. And we have four up. First off, I have Zachary Vishnoff. Next, after that, will be Patrick James Dizon. Sorry if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly on any of them. Louisa Hamachek. And finally, Jared Waybright. Okay. You are up.
Hi, I'm Zach Vishnoff. First, I got a brief question for you. Executive session, who decides who's media today? If I have a YouTube channel, does that make me media? I don't know. I didn't see any media in here taking notes on your meeting, and so I feel like the media today is kind of a joke, and so you might have a future discussion over whether independent researchers or independent media is allowed to listen. Maybe not comment, but listen to your executive sessions. I passed out this letter to the editor today. I hope you all got one. Not because it's well-written. It's not very informative. It does mention a Register Guard article about that toxic waste dump from many years ago that was, I thought, a pretty well-done article. You might familiarize yourself with that article. Mainly, I brought it to you to show that for over 5 years, I've asked questions about this publicly, and that there has been no response. And so I feel kind of outnumbered because, you know, everyone in town is worried about, oh, well, climate change and this kind of BS. But I think a toxic waste dump along the river that's been sitting there for years and that is not being cleaned up is just going to be capped and left as a gift to the future. I think I just think it needs a lot more scrutiny, and I do think there should be some executive summary. I think someone, you know, you've got a big staff here. I think some PR person or some technical person or the DEQ or whatever could do a little bit of outreach to explain to at least the people who are interested, when did you guys vote? Why did you guys vote the way you did as far as not cleaning it up? How many dollars you're saving by doing that? And what, is it going to go to subsidize some windmill in Washington? Or you're giving some money to this ridiculous U of O sports park, $250,000. Is that money you saved by not cleaning up the dump? I think there's about 100 questions I'd have that I'd like someone in your staff to answer. So, again, it's not a very good letter to the editor, but I'm just supplying it so that I don't seem like I just brought this up, because it's a lingering issue. And I think this overemphasis on this climate crap with the city of Eugene is, it's just a little tiring. Sure, we may have a problem in 10 or 20 years, but right now we have existing problems, and you guys are letting them.
Your time is actually.
Okay. Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Well, I guess the beep.
That could
is
be
not
over here, so maybe you need to reconfigure the room. Okay. But sorry for running late and for having a little bit of attitude. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next we have Patrick James Dizon. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that the sound wasn't running. I'll try to give you a nod when the 30 seconds is up.
To you have honorable commissioners, Sonia Carlson, John Brown, Dick Helzot, Mindy, sorry.
Good.
Brown, sorry. And to all managers and employees of eWeb, magandang gabi. Ako'y nagagalak na ako'y inyong pinagbigyan, na ako'y mapunta sa inyong lugar. I'm not cursing you anyway. In English, that is good evening. I'm very much happy that you allow me to stay in your place for 4 weeks. So my name is Patrick James Dizon. I'm from the Philippines. So I'm one of the 11 participants from our country. As professional fellowship program for the Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative. So this program is a U.S. government signature program under the United States Department of State's Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs. So to strengthen leadership development of young professionals like me and networking in Southeast Asia. So that is include Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Laos, Singapore, Thailand, Timor-Leste, and Vietnam. So it seeks to build the leadership capabilities of youth in the region, strengthening ties between the United States and Southeast Asia. So it brings emerging leaders like me, 18 years old to 35 years old, around the world to United States for extensive 6 weeks fellowship program. I'm here to represent the Metropolitan Water Works and Sewer System, the oldest water system in Asia, which is now 141 years old. So that's where I'm working. So MWSS is providing potable water to about 40 cities and municipalities around the National Capital Region of Metro Manila, so which is equivalent to 16 million customers. And so why I'm here? Last March 6, 2019, majority of our concession areas experienced low pressure and to no water in their system. So low pressure meaning that is below 7 psi of water pressure. So that is equivalent to 783,000 of water service connections. So the reason of this water crisis is due to El Nino phenomenon that hits the whole portion of the Philippines, wherein the only source of water is from the rain, where we are collecting and storing it to the dam during the rainy season. However, we experience minimal to no rain in our watershed area, which is supposed to be saturated the land and filled up our reservoirs. So maybe you will say why you don't.
Seconds.
Okay, sorry. When I visited the EWE facilities for 2 weeks, especially the Mackenzie River and Willamette River, I envied how abundant your water sources are. So also the minimum of 40 psi pressure shocks me every time I take a shower. And it's far different before we only experiencing around 7 psi of water. So with that, I just thank eWeb for letting me enjoy stay in the U.S. And I hope and I pray most remarkable success to eWeb. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Interesting to hear about your program. All right, Louisa Hamacek.
Hi, I'm Louisa Hamacek. I live in the 7th Ward on the other side of Skinner's Butte. And I've been there for 25 years, and what I'm coming to talk about is a warning about the Columbia Generating Station nuclear power plant, which is at the Hanford site. And EWEB is the seventh biggest customer in the Northwest of this nuclear power. And I would like you to, I would like us together, as I'm a owner, I've seen on the website. I'm a ratepayer of $500 a month for 25 years. I'd like you to and Eugene to lead the way in saying the nuclear power plant is unsafe and needs to be shut. And it comes from an article called that you could Google seismic time bomb Columbia Generating Station or just seismic time bomb to the Earth Island Journal article, which describes a recently discovered earthquake fault line that comes as part of the Seattle Fault. It's called the South Whidbey Island Fault, and it's all very clearly put into this article. And I hope you go to that. And my concern is that the nuke was not created big enough, strong enough for the 7.2 earthquake now expected. It was only built for 6.4, and it can handle a 6.8, but not 7.2. It will break. And I brought this up to Representative DeFazio because I think it's Congress who needs to immediately shut it. But I'm hoping that, the fear is the pipes will break. It's an old nuclear power plant, and the neutron bombardment has made pipes brittle. And the plumbing would, the cooling wouldn't happen. It would have a overheating meltdown and explode, fire into the air, fallout into the air. That would go in whatever way the wind is blowing. And 3 days ago on windy.com, I followed the little arrows, and I suggest you all look at windy.com. But the winds blow when they come from Spokane to Hanford or Richland, Washington. They are scooped into the Columbia Gorge, and they do come to here, to Eugene. So that's it, windy.com. So it was a warning, and I would love us to immediately shut the Columbia Generating Station and for Eugene to lead the way for the public utilities that use this electricity to say we don't need it. It's too dangerous. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, and finally for now, Jared Waybright.
Good evening. My name is Jared Waybright. I'm the executive director with the Mackenzie Watershed Council. I'm also a Eugene resident and Ward 1. So thank you for letting me speak tonight. I'm here to talk a little bit in support of one of the items on your consent calendar, specifically the five-year master service agreement proposed with Cascade Pacific RC&D. What that is, it's a long-term funding mechanism to support a program, the Pure Water Program, Pure Water Partners Program, that was jointly developed with EWEB and community organizations like the Watershed Council to engage private landowners in voluntary restoration and conservation projects that are designed to both protect drinking water quality and provide habitat and restore habitat for native species. The program was developed specifically to address some challenges that Mackenzie River Trust, Watershed Council, Soil and Water Conservation District had encountered over the years, namely challenges with outreach, inconsistent outreach, short-term cooperative agreements that we would form with private landowners, and inconsistent monitoring and reporting associated with specific projects. What this program does is allow us a programmatic approach to both outreach, defining baseline conditions and riparian conditions, and provide a mechanism to engage private landowners over the long term to protect these important drinking water sources and habitat conditions. Specifically the five-year master agreement would do a couple different things that is not currently being done right now. The long-term contract would allow for assurances or provide for a structure to give community partners like the Watershed Council a more structure and support for developing longer-term relationships with private landowners that are really critical for developing these voluntary projects. There's also a number of different efficiencies with longer-term contracting and grant development, leveraging outside dollars through OEB and other funding sources. So with that, I'd like to urge your support of this long-term funding contract with Cascade Pacific, and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Holly, do we have any others that have signed up, or is that? Okay. All right, that concludes the public input. We'll go through and ask if there's any comments from commissioners first. Any comments? Commissioner Helgeson?
Well, I'll just briefly comment on the testimony. Thank you for being here tonight and for sharing your thoughts and comments. With respect to the work that's being initiated on the other end of our site that has been loosely referred to here as a toxic waste site, there's a 20 or 25-year history of our engagement around mitigating the contamination on that site that comes not from EWEB's operation but from historical operations on that site that were due to other parties. And we have worked with DEQ and our partners in funding that effort over that entire 20-year period to do what is necessary to protect the public interest and public safety with respect to the conditions on that site. There are links on our website to information and a high-level summary of what that's about. And all of the information and correspondence and agreements relative to that effort are contained in the public record with DEQ under our docket. So we're not, I think the situation is that now that we're moving forward with the planned mitigation, people who may not have understood that this was even there are waking up and saying, what is this? So I would encourage you to learn more about what's in the record and the process that we've been through to make those decisions and start by reviewing what's already on our website. Patrick, I appreciate your appearance here tonight and your being here with us, and I hope that we can learn from you as much as you have the opportunity to learn from us. On the question of the Columbia Generating Station, I think this board has had a longstanding policy on nuclear. That's why, in part, that we participated in a decision some 25 years ago to shut down and decommission the Trojan plant on the Columbia. And thankfully, that plant is now largely behind us, although we do have the legacy of the nuclear waste that's associated with those facilities. I will simply state that, we are not a partner or a participant or an owner of Columbia Generating Station, and we are not on the board that governs that or manages the relationship with BPA around the purchase of the power that we do receive under our contract with Bonneville. I would be interested, and I think we've had in the past some brief briefing on this subject in memo form. I'd like to be reminded of how much of Bonneville's capacity this facility represents and the extent to which Bonneville or others might have contemplated some long-term plan to decommission that facility and what the implications might be in terms of decisions that we need to make in the context of our resource planning efforts. And if there's support for that, I'm not particularly concerned about the timing of that, but I know that the staff has background on that might be useful in terms of our future consideration. And I'll leave it there.
Okay.
I'd just like Patrick, thank you very much. It's really refreshing when somebody comes in and says thank you, and your enthusiasm is contagious. I really appreciate you coming in and telling me the great experience you've had here, and I just hope you get your water pressure up to 40. I mean, that's a tough one. You know, you got to run around the shower to get wet. That must be tough. So just take a shower twice a day while you're here and have fun and enjoy it. Zach, I get it. You know, I understand about the pollution and everything, but it's all over. You know, go up river here. The Alton Baker Park used to be a dump, and it's already leaching into the river. Go out in Roosevelt, where J.H. Baxter, at every corner in downtown Eugene, has toluene or petroleum products in it. It's not just isolated to this property, but we're listening to the professionals. We're spending the money necessary to be good stewards of the environment, and we're not walking away from it. It's something that we inherited when we bought, and we didn't pollute it. We bought it, and we're getting it by default, but we're not turning our nose against it and saying we're not doing anything. We're being good stewards of what we own, so I appreciate your concern, but I think that we're handling it well. And Louisa, Dick said it all. I mean, we can't control what Bonneville does, but we understand the issue with Hanford. So, and Jared, don't think we're going to have a problem. I hope not. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Just thank you for all the public participation. It's always great to see when people come out and give us your views. This is your utility. So thank you again for taking the time. I know it's not easy being up there and being interrupted when the timing is coming up. I know it throws you off. So I really appreciate you coming out this evening. Okay, we will close the public hearing. And we will move on to General Manager Employment Agreement Amendment. So for this, we have John Brown is our, Commissioner Brown is our appointed liaison for this topic. So I'm going to pass it over to him to give us the main talking points here.
Okay, so we all have an attachment that is going to be, and we have 5 points that we're going to discuss. And we have General Counsel Eric DeVriest and Lena Kostopoulos with HR to help me through this little conversation. And so we talked about it. So the first issue was about vacation accrual and methodology. The board, and I think what we'll go down here, and we've all been briefed on what this means and everything, and I think input to give Eric and Lena some direction on where we go about completing this document and making a motion. So we'll just go down and if you want to start with Mindy and go this way, is that way you prefer to do it?
That's okay. Fine.
And
just,
you want to weigh in on where you are on number one, the vacation accrual for the general manager?
Just give my opinion mm-hmm. on it.
Do you want to give like just a quick summary of what the points are?
Okay. The very first point was to align general manager's his vacation accrual with EWIB employee policy. So over 240 vacation true-up can occur at the year end. So as long as he takes 80 hours a year, he can accrue vacation same the way as all the other employees do. There's a disconnect between that, and it's just to make his vacation accrual consistent with what the employees are.
Okay.
So I think it's a good idea to get it in line with how the rest of EWEB operates. So I'm in favor of that.
Commissioner Hobson?
I would concur. And just as context, these are elements that relate to our existing employment contract with the general manager, which was put in place 3 years ago and has not been revisited substantively since then. Many of the other points that we will be discussing tonight in public session are simply matters of either clarifying or syncing up with existing organizational practice the elements of the contract, which in some cases do not have methodologies or specifics sufficiently defined so as to be clear about how they work. And so when we talk about vacation accruals, this is just adding more specificity and some adjustments to that provision of the contract so as to make it consistent with existing policy, which I would support. And I would hope that at the end of the discussion that Commissioner Brown, that you would indicate to us in principle what the effect of this provision would be once implemented relative to what we have now.
Okay, that's okay. Doable. Okay. The next item is about,
wait,
oh, I'm sorry, I missed you.
So I am also in favor of aligning with the policy that affects the other eWeb staff members or managers. The only point that I would make, adding on to Dick's comment, is that there's also a market component. So there are some of these policies that we're also aligning with, more standard contracts within the market. So, okay.
And I'm also in agreement with it, with what others have said. The next item is the methodology of the base salary adjustment and how that works. Right now, the average base salary of the 2, 4, 6, 8 general managers throughout the region that have similar operations to eWeb, the average is 296,978. The base with the high and the low removed is 291, and the eWeb base right now is 289. And what we're trying to do is get to a process where we can have the general manager and clarify in the contract how his base is calculated along with the merit pay. So what he's talked about is that you go into the adjustment, does it incorporate a merit factor and clarifying how this works. And is Eric, is it all right if I read from the document that I was given on your item on number 2?
At your discretion.
At my discretion. All right, and you'll keep me in line if I'm getting, okay. So basically, the revised methodology for comparing the base salary would have the board consider the mean range of the industry comparators and then modify the base salary by accounting for the general manager's performance. And right now, the general manager's performance for the last 2 years has been exemplary. And the proposal or what's on the table is to go to fully performing, which is below the exemplary category, just to align it with that. And am I stating that correct, Lena?
Yes, there is for the non-bargained employees, there's a range that says 95 to 105% is the fully performing range. And it is possible for an exceptionally performing employee to be placed at 105% of the midpoint, and then you can address merit in your discussion. But merit could be given as a base level increase above that, or it could be given as a one-time increase in addition to that. So he would be at the top of the fully performing range, sort of on the edge, and that's kind of the cliff for where you go to exceptional. Does that answer your question?
That's fine. Yeah, no, because he's been rated as exceptional for the last 2 years.
Yes.
By moving him to the top of the cliff of fully performing, mm-hmm. would move his salary from 289 to 311.
Yes,
would be the math on that. And so basically, it's more the methodology about doing that. So, am I clear?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what I understand is just that it's again the way looking at Frank's base salary is more in line with the way the base salary is determined for other leadership positions at eWeb. Is that correct?
Well, it's close to correct. There is no salary range for the general manager, so that's really sort of determined by the mean to the marketplace, and the board has a list of historical comparators. So there's a minor distinction there, but yes, you're on the right track.
Okay, thank you. So I would be in support of this.
I support this, and I don't really see it as a significant change in as much as the existing contract provisions are market-based and make reference to a methodology that's not specified in any detail in the agreement. And this simply, to me, puts some mechanics around that and allows us to manage the base salary component in a manner consistent with our intent, but with clarity about what the mechanics look like, and pending coming back with some language to implement this to make sure it's consistent with what has been described to me as an element of this discussion, I support it.
Okay. I am also supportive of the provision in that I think it's good for us to align with the way others within the within EWEB are evaluated and compensated for their performance. I appreciate that Frank is asking only to be at the very lowest end of the exceptional rating, even though we've rated him as exceptional for the last 2 years. So I am in support of the proposal as it is.
And I as well. Item number four is whether to modify the methodology for considering subjective one-time award. Number three, to incorporate methodology for automatic adjustment to base salary at the beginning of each calendar year in accordance with objective market factors such as CPI. And basically is to move this with a floor of 2% and a ceiling of 4%. I mean, if the CPI is 10, his salary can't go up. But if the CPI is 1.8, it goes up 2. And that is what the proposal is. There is an issue on the legality of us binding future boards to this. And, Eric, would you just give us some language on how we can work through that so we can be consistent with and not break that law or break that perception of law for future boards?
Yes, I can provide that.
Okay, you can give us that direction so we can stay within the confines of not binding a future board.
Correct.
If they want to do away with this,
I can give you different options.
Because his contract exceeds that time period. Thank you. Just for clarity to other people. So go ahead.
So for the purposes of this discussion, do you want to give us the options and then we'll deliberate on them in the public session so that you can bring them back? Or?
Well, in order to avoid any sort of appearance of binding future boards when we're dealing with an employment contract for the general manager. The board is of finite tenure because you have rolling elections for the different members. In order to address that, we can set it up to be such as a five-year term for a contract, which the present board each year, then present board, can renew that or extend that term by an additional year or an additional 2 years so that it keeps moving forward with the grace of the present board rather than just setting, you know, a date way out in the future of 10, 12 years or what have you, which exceeds the terms of the board members. We would set it up to be 5 years and then the board would maintain discretion to move forward and extend it by 1 year on an annual basis.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're good on that?
I just want to make sure I understand this one. It's saying that the general manager gets a guaranteed cost of living allowance between 2 and 4% every year. Is that what this is?
Yes.
And is that consistent with other EWEB employees? Is there a...
We don't actually refer to that adjustment as a cost of living adjuster, but in the non-bargained unit, we look at a CPI factor. It's the same one that we did bargain with, the IBEW.
Okay.
There is not a minimum or maximum threshold for the non-bargained workers. There is for the IBEW unit. So, yes, and that will occur in January.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So
I'm okay with
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I'm okay with this, but just as a clarification, since this functions within a floor and a ceiling, will the language that's brought back address how we establish the point in between that floor and ceiling, and at least the references to the indexes that will be used, so that will be clear on its face?
Well, what has happened, Commissioner, is that we have used the same CPI index for years and years, and last year it was discontinued. So we negotiated a new one with the IBEW, but there are others being contemplated in the region for the future. So I think if we did, and this is an open question for legal counsel, if we said that it would be one that is consistent with that which is used for the non-bargained unit, I think that might do what it is that you want. I'm not able to really predict a specific index far out into the future since we know that this one will be reconsidered.
I don't know that I would need it to be far out into the future, but I think if we're going to, I'm fine with an adjustment provision that relies on some index
sure.
and a methodology that's at least
we have largely
consistent, but I think it needs to be sufficiently defined so that it can act on its own, and I'm understanding that that would not, without board intervention, be something that we would consider on an annual basis other than to acknowledge the action of the
sure.
formula.
Okay, yes, we can do that.
Okay, I'm good with that.
Okay, so if this other index went away, then we would have the opportunity as a board to implement or look at another sort of index that would relatively operate the same way.
What is likely to happen is we would have to re-bargain something with the IBEW, and then the non-bargained employees would track with that, and we would probably do that either in board correspondence or ask for a decision or an endorsement from the board as it contemplates the general manager's compensation.
Okay. That I'm in support of it, as long as we have the ability if something happened there that we can. So we're not binding future boards because we are going to renew it annually, but that would be part of the discussion that we would undertake annually.
Yes.
And if that came out, then we would look at the relative a new comparator. Okay. Then I'm in support.
So I just have a technical question, Lena. So they've done away with the Portland CPI, and so now we're looking at places like San Francisco and Seattle. Are you using Western states?
The one that we have arrived at is the West Class, and it's the BC Index, and it is the closest we could get. Its population centers in the Western United States under 2 million.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you. So I'm good with it, too.
In the future, they're looking at things like chain CPI and some other things, and so we'll keep you informed.
Okay, thank you. The next item is whether to modify the methodology for considering subjective one-time award for adjustments to the base salary based upon merit within the first quarter of each year. And I know that we have a recommendation to remove the language in the existing contract. So the merit increase to get the word in there right now says the merit increase to base salary can be removed, so we don't do that merit increase to the base each time it comes up. Am I paraphrasing
yes.
that correctly? So basically that would just be the merit basis in the first quarter of each year. We would
for one time.
Of one time,
yep.
yes. It wouldn't be to the base salary. It'd be if we just said that here. Exemplary again, we wanted to give you a bonus or a merit base or whatever. We could do that. It could be the salary, but it could be a lump sum or it could be some other benefit.
I have a quick question, if I may. I think there was a reference to the first quarter, and I don't believe that we would have the necessary information. I think that if I recall the specific proposal, and I don't have it here in front of me, but it asks for the average of the merit award given to the non-bargain group, and we wouldn't have that number until halfway through the month of April. So it would have to happen later on. I think generally in May is the timing that we have used for the performance evaluation process. I would submit that the board might want to contemplate staying with that.
Okay, I'm just reading from Eric's background on the top of the
okay.
page where it says it the performance review within the first quarter of each year.
Okay.
And so, maybe, but thank you for clarifying that if we can't do it, we can't do it. We got to have the numbers.
Would the board be comfortable if counsel and I went away and looked at the actual timing and then he would write the proposed agreement based on that and for your consideration and execution?
Okay.
We could.
Go ahead.
Set it up on contingency of rather than tying it to the first quarter, tying it to within a reasonable time after receipt of
sure.
the key information.
That seems to
and that would maintain timeliness.
Okay.
So again, just some clarification. What this is doing is it's pulling merit out because previously merit and base were all lumped in together. So this is just making
yes.
it a little cleaner
yes.
that way. Okay, so I'm okay with that.
So am I.
And I also agree with the new language as proposed.
Okay, I'm good with it. And the last thing is whether to modify the voting requirements for without cause termination and or extend the contract severance period from 6 to 12 months. As this is kind of a two-prong type of thing. Basically, the proposal was to go from 3 votes to 4 votes to require a termination to basically remove the general manager without cause, and then also to modify the contract to where a removal without cause would require 12 months of severance, with cause, 12 months of severance. Without cause, excuse me. Sorry. Without cause for 12 months of severance. You don't get severance if it's with cause. So did I state that correctly?
I believe
and
so.
And again, we're running up against the issue with the 5-year committing a future board to something. Is that not correct?
Correct.
In this item as well. And you would propose, I would assume that you're going to propose the same solution that you proposed in the CPI on binding a few boards till we roll it over on a 5-year.
Correct. That maintains discretion in the current board rather than binding a future board.
And so since this has two parts, it has going from 3 votes to 4 votes for termination without cause and up from 6 months to 12 months severance, I assume that it'd be best for you that we answer both of those independently because they're not tied together.
Yes.
That's correct. Okay. So we have two questions in front of you.
Okay. So first of all, with the termination without cause, I think what we heard previously is that 12 months is pretty standard among general managers.
Yes.
So again, this is getting this more in line with what is policy that's out there. So I'm okay with that. I do have a problem with requiring at least 4 commissioners to vote for that. I totally get the understanding if you get a new slate of people in that want to kind of clean house. I understand that. But I also think then it just makes it exceptionally difficult to get rid of somebody if you don't want them, and you can run into the same problem the other way.
Just sitting here.
So that I'm leaning against that provision, but I do support moving to 12 months severance.
I too would be opposed to requiring a supermajority, I'll call it, in order to terminate without cause. I think that regardless of how much we appreciate the services of our general manager, and we do, and this is not a provision that's intended to address any foreseen circumstance. But that notwithstanding, I think that the board should always retain discretion around that employment relationship. And in addition to that, I really wouldn't want to see a situation where 3 out of 5 board members wish to terminate the general manager for whatever reason, and we're left in a relationship over a period of time where because we don't have that fourth, even though we have a majority and we don't have a fourth commissioner so inclined, we're left in a rather difficult relationship that would be, I think, difficult for all parties concerned. So for that reason, I would favor, in order to sort of balance the interests here, syncing up our contract at 12 months severance, as we've indicated, and leaving the discretion of the board with respect to what constitutes a board majority in this case at its current and understood level of 3 out of 5, or I don't know how many out of 4 if one of us, as is tonight, not here, but I would object to changing that as the thing that would be most binding to the board.
Similarly, I oppose the 4 board member requirement and agree with aligning the 12 months with the market standard. I am curious, though, because, I mean, this one, it really does seem to bind more future board members. I mean, obviously, we have 3 that are against that provision already, so that's likely out. But the previous one with the CPI seems slightly different to me in that it doesn't seem as large of an issue. I'm wondering about the requirement to renew every year, if that is really the only provision that's pushing that forward. If we had agreed on, if the board had decided that having four members was the minimum requirement, then I think that provision of having a yearly review would be more necessary. But having a COLA escalator doesn't seem as egregious to me. Now, maybe you can talk a little bit more to that point, because that would then open up a contract discussion every year outside of just a regular pay piece, which opens up a whole other set of negotiation around the contract instead of just whether or not you're paid or not. So if you can talk a little bit about how those two are different, or how they're, the same.
The CPI or whatever objective escalator is still a mandate upon whatever future board. It need not be that there's a rolling each year you address to extend it out further. It can be 5 years and renewable and 5 year sections, so long as we're observing that you're not going beyond the majority of the commissioners, through going beyond the expiration of 3 out of 5 commissioners, and so of their term. And so it could be just revisiting every 5 years, 4 or 5 years. I'd have to do the math, and I don't do the math well, just off the cuff here, protecting that interest to make sure that you're not binding a future board. I just don't want to see that become an issue in the future.
Okay, and I'm not interested in having to open up the contract if the person is performing well, and I mean, we're still noting that they're at will. So if they are, not performing well, it's still up to the board, whoever that board is composed of, to say yes or no, we don't want you to be here, or yes, we do want you to be here. But I know how onerous this process can be if you're opening up that frequently. So
and
I would be more in favor of having a 5-year term.
Yeah. And I'm not meaning that it need to be a full discussion. It could be a consent calendar item as to extending out the contract.
Okay.
Get going to get back in the queue.
Okay, I
didn't
know if you wanted to go in then. Okay. Jump in.
I'd be happy to wait for Commissioner Brown.
I'm good with the 12 months, and I'm good with keeping it at 3, but that is a double-edged sword. Because when the majority of this board rolls over in one election, a special interest group could take this board over and they could scrap every program we've ever done, the IERP, the watershed protection. I mean, they could just absolutely can everything. I'm not fearful that that's going to happen. I'm fearful the other thing is going to happen and that we're going to persevere and we're going to continue on the good track that we're on. And so I'm good with the 3 out of 5 and keeping it that way. So.
Well, my response to that is that's one of the risks of our form of governance, and you're not going to get around that if you're going to be true to the expectations of the community in terms of our representational role in managing the operation. So I also want to push back a little bit on this notion of binding future boards. I'm thinking about our procurement contracts, and, there are escalators in those. There are provisions in those that, in some sense, as long as we're in the contractual relationship, bind us to certain actions. There is no contract that, we would have with the general manager that, in some sense, doesn't bind us, because all the provisions define the nature of the relationship, which is an at-will relationship and subject to termination by the board. So, for me, as long as we don't adopt this provision 5 requiring a supermajority, and as long as that contract remains at will in a legal sense, and as long as the board under conditions retains the right to terminate the contract, I'm not sure why we got a problem. I also don't think that a 5-year rolling contract really meets the threshold of protection of the interest that you describe, Eric, because that a 5-year rolling contract, if you were to refuse to or wish not to renew it, in definition extends beyond the term of any commissioner, so I'm not sure that it cures the problem. So I would ask you, as you consider ways to resolve your very important to us concerns, that you take into account my points, and in what you bring back to us, you don't hamstring that any further than necessary in order to protect the interest that you describe it. And from my standpoint, not as a legal expert, but as a participant in many contracts, feel that as long as the board in any event retains the right to terminate the agreement and we don't implement a supermajority, recognizing that there are conditions and requirements of any contract that would bind the board in one way or other, even in vacation accruals or whatever, we not make the cure to your concern any more complicated than it needs to be.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you.
You have what you need so we can huddle up and get back to this group?
I think we have. When we bring a contract back, probably in the consent calendar next month, or would you like this to be an agenda item for the purpose of executing the modified agreement?
I would like to see it as an agenda item.
Okay.
Especially for the purposes of, are there commissioner who is not present.
Yeah, and I will say for the record that I'm going to talk to Commissioner Mattel about all his perspectives and viewpoints on each one of these points and make sure that I get that to you as well, because he unfortunately wasn't able here to express his desires in public. But
thank you. And one final question then, with regard to making the adjustment to the approximate $311,000, what is the date that you would want to do that? That would need to be in place for us to apply the escalator in January. So I would submit that it should probably happen sometime in December if the board chooses to execute the agreement.
Hmm. That's a good question.
I would just encourage you to help us define the mechanics of that.
Certainly.
When you bring back the information. And I think our intent is to have one mechanism for adjusting base salary that's based on market considerations and inflators such as you've described, that would happen as soon as practicable in the beginning of the year, consistent with other classes of employees, and that that merit component that's considered later be synced up with timing language that meets our intent to have that happen in conjunction with the normal performance review cycle.
Thank you.
Frank, would you like to comment at all?
Well, absolutely.
Chance here. Sorry about that.
There's quite a few EWEB employees in the audience. And yes, this is awkward, just so you know. But I would say the objective with the contract is to align with the policies that we have in place for all of our employees. And there are two really important factors in that. One is, are we being competitive in the market? And the other, are we rewarding for performance? Those two things are incredibly important to me, not just because of this position or this contract, but because of the fact that it's the entire organization that should also be reflective in that concept. I do think there's opportunities to make certain things more objective, tied to the market, look at other general managers. Those have been incorporated. But ultimately, it comes back to being consistent with our policies that we would that we would use independent of the position. And so I think that's an important message to send to the organization. It's an important message to send to future general managers and future boards. And so while the numbers can be daunting from time to time, I think that the philosophies are what drive what we do and the policies. And so thank you for having the discussion. Supermajority aside, I totally get that as part of the democratic process. I would expect that if it's a performance-based discharge, it should be 5-0. If it's a non-performance-based, then there's some clear directional change that either the board or the general manager or both don't agree with. And that happens from time to time because of the form of governance. But I appreciate you being willing to have the conversation and Eric's help and Lena's help in understanding what it means. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a need for a motion to direct legal counsel on this? No?
Is this what notices an action
There is
item?
A motion that was provided in the documents. If you'd like
procedure.
I'm asking, it's your...
It does just say direction here. No. It doesn't say action on the agenda.
There's a...
So I understand that he proposed that, but if we're not actually voting on a final document, I don't see that there's necessarily...
Right, we'll bring back a document for you in accordance with your direction here in open council.
We'll
bring that back
question.
For the agenda.
Very quickly.
Just as a matter of process, to the extent that the changes in methodology that we've described here with respect to base pay would result in some adjustment as of the beginning of the year, will that be addressed as part of the actions that we take on the contract, or will that be addressed subsequently as the mechanics of that new language kick in, you know, in December or January or however that works? So I heard tonight that there would be some adjustment to base pay in the initial placement of this based on some of the figures that Commissioner Brown brought. And I'm just wanting to be clear, are we going to deal with the establishment of the level of that base pay at the same time that we adopt the new contract language?
My understanding is that the contract that council would prepare would afford that, and it would provide
okay.
a date, an effective date. And then once the commission has executed that agreement, the matter of the CPI adjustment would just happen automatically.
Okay.
I can certainly notify the board by way of correspondence about what the final figure is in January when that adjustment is made, and that can become something that's
okay.
annual.
It was
if
mostly
that's your
just
preference.
A process question, so thank you
yeah.
for your answer.
All right, moving on. We will go to approval of the consent calendar. Does anybody wish to pull any of the items? I actually would like to pull number 2, so if there's any others.
I don't need to pull an item, but there was a reference in one of the items to a provision of board policy that had to do with required fees and or, you know, things that were non-discretionary, and I won't try to resurrect that here or pull the item for that purpose, but later in the meeting when we close out, I'll ask for a response and a reminder as to what those elements are, because I didn't really understand the reference in the consent calendar item request, and I'm sorry to
okay.
the, I don't have it right in front of me, but I'll
okay.
Come back there.
I'll come back to it quickly at the end of the meeting.
I'll move to adopt the consent calendar item, but minus item number 2.
Okay, second. All right, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All right, motion passes. All right, moving on to consent calendar item number 2. Can we please get appropriate staff up? I'd like to get, there was some concern by a board member that I'd like to get a little bit more feedback just about the program, and if you can give a little bit of an overview of what the intent is.
I'll try and channel my inner Carl here. So what we're trying to do here is be as transparent as possible. So there's roughly 3 programs, and Jared talked a lot about them. And so we normally budget those per year in the O&M budget, and all these programs have come together. The administration of, and they're leveraged through a bunch of grants and that kind of thing. And so to provide consistent administration that's not being done through EWEB, that's what the $70,000 portion is for. So it's roughly 10% of the total that we would be paying into per year. So these are just sort of estimates. So really, the amount of approval we're looking for here is fairly small. It's $70,000 over 5 years. What we are trying to do is be transparent that it's roughly amounts to $700,000 over a period of 5 years.
In partnering with the other groups
Correct.
That they leverage.
Right.
Understood. Okay. I don't have any other questions. Do you have, okay.
Is that our share, or is that the combined share of all participants?
That's our share.
Okay. And as with other contracts, subject to whatever constraints on the board's discretion are contained in that contract, do we, is that subject to our annual appropriations as with other procurement contracts. So this is an estimate of the expenditures that would accrue, but we continue to retain budgetary control
over
the period of the contract, as with other procurements.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So this is a master services agreement, and so any work that's approved under this contract is set up as a task order. So only work that's approved and negotiated based on the dollar amount approved in the budget would be awarded under the contract.
Okay.
Okay, I'm good.
I'll move to adopt consent calendar item number 2.
Second.
All right, all those in favor, say aye.
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 All right, motion passes. And moving along. So we are now at 2020 proposed budgets and prices.
Just a point of order. We have a public hearing scheduled to start at 7:25. Are we worried about butting up against that hard time?
Well, it's only a problem, my understanding, is if it is, if it happens before that, but not after.
We're good.
Correct.
We're good? Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioners. Sue Fahey, Assistant General Manager and Chief Financial Officer. With me this evening, I have Nate Schultz, Senior Financial Analyst, Adam Roof, Fiscal Services Supervisor, and Deborah Hart, Financial Services Manager. We were before you last month to discuss the draft budgets that staff had prepared. They have gone back and created proposed budgets, and we're before you tonight to discuss the proposed budget and prices. So with that, I'll pass it over to Deborah.
Thank you, and good evening. As Sue just stated, we are here this evening to review the 2020 proposed budget and updates to budgets and updates to prices. Followed by a public hearing this evening, after which we'll be seeking board direction on the 2020 budgets and prices. This pie chart represents the total company budget summarized. This is the budget, the same budget that we showed in October, and the detail was provided in the board backgrounder this month. As a reminder, electric O&M is the largest part of the budget, and roughly half of that is purchased power expense. I did want to highlight a few key changes from 2019, and that included a $14 million increase in purchased power. That was largely due to an accounting change, how we need to account for book out transactions. There's an offset in wholesale revenue. A dollar-for-dollar offset, so there is no net impact to our contribution margin from that accounting change. There is also higher electric and water capital spending of $12 million and $3 million, respectively. Those capital plans are similar to what was provided in July, and for the electric utility, it does include increased spending for the Carmen Smith relicensing effort, rehabilitation and expansion work that includes resiliency, and meter replacement and technology projects. It also includes general capital for the replacement of aging infrastructure. And for the water utility, they are also focused on replacement of aging infrastructure, as well as meter upgrades and the construction of a new water quality laboratory. There are decreased O&M costs that were due to PERS reductions. That was the result of paying off the transition liability late last year, as well as the deposit to the site account, which happened on November 1st of this year. And there were also shifts from O&M to capital as a result of the higher capital plan. So with that, I'll pass it off to Adam to talk about the price proposals.
Thanks, Deborah. So this is an overview of the price proposal for the water and electric utilities. The first note that we wanted to highlight is there's no change in overall revenue requirement. This is the fifth of the last 6 years for the electric utility and the third consecutive year for the water utility that we have not required a rate increase. We also prepared the cost of service analysis for both water and electric utilities and are recommending no change in the residential and commercial classes based on those results. Although one of the classes was over that 5% threshold that we've used and that we pointed to in the past. We considered some mitigating circumstances, including the extended Lieberg outage, where when we added those wholesale revenues back into the model, it fell within the 5%, and then also the no overall increase kind of factored into that recommendation. Although we're not proposing an overall change, there are a few rate changes or price changes that we were, annual updates that we were gonna ask for approval for. These are based on wholesale power market changes primarily. Both the partial requirement service and the distributed generation rates are rates in place for customers with generation that they're selling back to EWEB. We're using wholesale power prices as the benchmark for those rates and providing customers access to wholesale markets through us. So that's the update that gets updated annually based on changes in market prices. The business growth and retention rate also has a market element where we're, for eligible customers, providing the difference between wholesale and retail and splitting that value between EWEB and the customers for that business growth. For the final one was the water contract prices. For electric contract customers, those point to the COSA methodology as an exhibit update, so those don't come to the board. They just get annually updated through that process, regardless of whether or not the board implements the COSA results for residential and commercial classes. The water contract customers have a similar analysis that drives those price updates, but the contracts do state that the board will approve those price changes. So although we are not recommending implementing the results of the COSA, we are for the contract customers as we do for the electric contract customers by practice. So there's a couple other changes that we had related to the customer service policies that aren't directly related to price updates. For the large general service, we're proposed language to allow customers of that size to be served under that rate schedule or by contract. We currently have a customer served on by contract that fits into that category, so we just wanted to codify that language and that practice for that customer. We have similar language in our very large general service rate that we've moved into that schedule as well. Finally, for system development charges, there's a more significant modifications to that customer service policy. There's three key changes, the first one being collapsing that the 5/8 and 3/4 inch meter charge to under 1 inch meter charge, which is aligned with what was approved last year for the water rates as we move to implementing the new meter standard. We collapse those two into one rate. Additionally, we've modified the language to accommodate the accessory dwelling units and their lesser impact to the system in terms of the system development charge. And finally, we've codified the practice for the limited income waivers for system development charges. That's been a historical practice that we've put into the policies for those housing developments. So that's an overview of the proposed price changes. Next, we're moving into the bill comparison chart that we show periodically. This was last shown to the board in July. We're in the, without any overall rate change, we're in the same position. This is based on the single-family household that with electric heating, 1,600 kilowatt hours and 9 kcals. Over the last several years, we've moved to the left a couple places on that chart. Although we are in the same place as we were last July on the sixth from the lowest rate. That's a combination of the water utility being the second lowest of the 17 comparators and the electric utility being the eighth lowest in about the middle of the pack on that chart. So with that, I'll turn it back to Deborah for recommendations.
Thank you. This evening, management is recommending that the board direct staff to prepare 2020 budgets and price updates as presented in the board materials. And before we talk about next steps, I did just want to highlight the process as it's gone so far this year. It started back in June with capital improvement plan assumptions and priorities from the engineering and operations group, the 10-year CIP, as well as 2020 budget assumptions and long-term financial plans were brought here in July. There were presentations on the water system infrastructure as well as the electric system infrastructure, and then the 2020 draft budgets. And that brings us to this evening. There's the first of two public hearings this evening. We'll take direction from the board and then be bringing that back in December for a second public hearing, after which we'll be seeking board approval.
Well, we will now move into public hearing on the 2020 proposed budgets and prices. Do we have anybody that's signed up?
Are you going to speak for public hearing?
Yeah. Am I the only one?
Oh, do you have another one? Okay, let me look back here.
No, that's a sorry
right.
Situation.
Yep.
Oh, I see. Both were seen. Selected. Do you have a timer?
You want me to time it? I'd love to.
Okay.
Maybe if someone can go like this when it's 25
yeah, that
seconds,
would be helpful.
Since my
yeah.
eyes go this
I
way.
Understand. Normally we have a buzzer, but it
yeah.
wasn't working. So.
I don't see anything in this budget about the remediation, and so I'm wondering, is the money you spent so long ago that it's not listed here, or is this just a really general thing that kind of fudges over thorny issues like that? I did see some mention of it in tonight's intergovernmental agreements in the consent calendar. If it's part of an intergovernmental agreement, there should be part of that agreement, not just, you know, U of O, City of Eugene, and you guys. So it's just, it kind of smells that it's not more public. I want to respond to some discussion earlier of 20 to 25 years. This has supposedly been going around. I'm underwhelmed by the amount of outreach that's happened. And I think that if the public were engaged, then you would know what the public interest is. I don't think it's one person's opinion what if the public's interest is served. I think it should be a public discussion. I think these meetings should be televised. I think energy and water and all this is really important. Seems like a real no-brainer. It can be done pretty cheaply if you look into it. I wonder if this intergovernmental agreement with this remediation came up in the executive session. I don't know if I'll get an answer on that, but I'm curious about that and why it would need to be executive session. The other thing, I think you guys acquired the land with the dump, and maybe there's some remediation taking place, but I think the ethic of leaving it in a better state than when you got it is a good thing to go by. And I just think that's not really happening. So I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to make some counterpoints.
30 seconds.
Okay. Did anyone on this board go look at what was being dug up while it was being dug up? Because I went and looked into this pit during the process. I kind of covered myself and just stared in there, and it was rather frightening. So I'm just wondering if any of you bothered to go check it out or maybe got on a respirator. And that's about it.
Thank you for your time. Okay, I don't think there were any others. So we will move on to it looks like we're scheduled for a break at this time, and then we'll come back for direction. Does that work, or would there be interest
hearing.
In? Oh, sorry, yes. Closing the public hearing. Thank you. Would we like to give the comments while they're sitting here instead of having a break?
Yes.
That seems to make more sense.
Sorry, take a break after we finish that. Item 10, yeah. I guess.
Okay,
need a
let's
break?
Move forward.
We've only got one other agenda.
Having that. Okay. Review that afterwards. So let's actually give feedback. Moving forward, any comments? Commissioner Helgeson.
First, I want to respond to the public testimony and say that, yes, I was on staff, actually, at the time that we did some of the initial reconnaissance on that site. I was, my office at the time was at the steam plant. I was engaged in work with the environmental manager around the operations of the steam plant, so I was in proximity so as to be able to observe all that I'm knowledgeable about and have recollections of what that was. I would disagree with your characterization, but I will set that aside. And I think you won't see this or any other thing at that level identified in the budget document in its specific detail, but as in deference to your interest, I would ask staff as part of the information provided back as a result of tonight's discussion to identify for the board the amount of money that's in the budget next year for these purposes, and that may shed some light on Mr. Bishanoff's interest in knowing that. I'm pleased to see that the contract customers, including the water districts, continue to see annual adjustments that are COSA-based. In those cases, because those are contractual relationships, I'd be concerned if those ran for periods of time and then they ended up with surprises or unexpected things. And I'm glad that we continue to manage our other customers within that plus or minus 5% bandwidth. The only two things that concern me with respect to the SDC changes have to do with the revisions to the language for methodology and considering waivers for low-income housing, and I think what you're bringing is generally consistent with within the parameters that the board set originally when it authorized such waivers. I think the two things that I don't see in what you've brought as a draft, and I would ask you to consider and maybe to have some explicit board discussion around as we move to adopt those changes. One is that in the board's original consideration, there was an annual limit on the amount of money that could be devoted to that purpose. I think the board was concerned, although the fact is that we haven't seen many of those requests rise above a certain level over the years, that could rise to a level uncontrolled that would be above what was the board's comfort level at the time. And that was, at the time, $100,000 annually. That may or may not be an appropriate limit. So the first question would be whether or not, in the board's consideration as a policy matter, as we recraft that language, we should preserve some annual limit on that. The second piece is whether or not those appropriations should be subject to board approval, because I think, well, it is expedient and maybe fairly reasonably and easily accomplished to have those approved at the staff level, at least at the time the board's interest was in seeing those and understanding those as a contribution and a waiver of fees that we would normally assess, but in support of a public purpose that we were aligned with, and so the board had an interest in seeing and having a role in approving those. That may or may not be something that the board cares about at this point, but those would be two points in relation to what you're proposing that I'm generally comfortable with that I'd like to have us consider specifically as part of that adoption, and also get your feedback on as to whether they continue to be appropriate. Thank you.
Any comments on Commissioner Helgeson's remarks?
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Helgeson. So the policy, proposed policy as written, requires any annual amount in SDCs waived over $100,000 to be approved by the general manager. The waivers will also be included in the community investment report in the quarterly report, so the board will get that information every quarter. So their staff would not be approving anything over $100,000 annually in the aggregate or $50,000 individually for a waiver.
Without the general manager.
Without the general manager, correct.
And my question is just simply in the board's consideration, and I appreciate that point of view, and that may be perfectly workable, but that we visit that and make that decision as a policy change explicitly in our consideration, because it varies from the board's original intent when this was authorized. And I'd be comfortable with where we land on that, but I just think it's a point that ought to be addressed and considered by the board explicitly.
Anybody else want to jump in the queue?
Good.
I just have a quick question about the SDCs. So that we have the policy change for reduced SDCs for small housing units, so that's just water. Did we do that the same for electric? Have we done, is that something we already did, or are we thinking about doing it? Because I know that that's something that people complain about a lot when they're trying to build a small, tiny house or something.
Yeah, there's no SDCs on the electric side. It's just water side. The cost of extending infrastructure on the electric side is paid by the developer.
So that, like, if somebody builds a tiny house in their backyard, they're not getting charged an SDC.
No, just to get the whatever extension is to the tiny home.
Okay, thank you. I was confused.
Well, and I had just a clarification. One, I should say thank you for answering my extensive list of questions last night. But there was one question that that I still don't feel like I got a full answer to. So I asked about the River Road Santa Clara Water District charges. It seems that there's a price increase factored into those, and I wanted to find out what the contributing price increases are. I understand that the COSA is what drives that, but what inside of the COSA? The COSA itself seems like this sort of black box nebulous thing that we don't really have any sense of. The staff do it, it happens, I get that, but there must be driving factors that are increasing those prices for the River Road, Santa Clara Water District area and the others. And if you have any sense of what those major drivers are inside of the COSA, that would be helpful to me.
Yeah. The allocations for the wholesale customers within the COSA have primarily not changed from last year. What has changed and what is driving that are additional O&M expenses overall, and because we use the utility basis for those wholesale customers, and we have a 10% return on the rate base. There's a depreciation expense component that also gets allocated to that. So the driving factor with those customers is related to additional O&M expenses and depreciation expense.
So in order to service those customers, I mean, I can understand that may cost more in order just operation. So that's one of the factors, and then the depreciation. So how does that relate to an actual cost to the price increase? Because some of that doesn't, I'm sorry, that's not clear to me, how the depreciation actually costs us.
So it is confusing. You're right to be confused. There are two bases for doing COSA. One's more of a cash base, and the other, as Nate mentioned, is a utility basis. The way the water district contracts are worded is we use the alternate utility basis, not the cash basis, the way the rest of our customer classes do. The big difference in that is instead of paying for capital as you go, the water districts do not pay until it's put in service and depreciation is started on that asset. Okay. And because we had all the work at Hayden Bridge over the last couple of years and put those assets in service, that's a big factor in the increase.
I think you said that in that paragraph. It just didn't sink in. So thank you both for clarifying that. Okay. Other than that, wonderful budget. Thank you for all of your work. I know that this is not an easy process. So did you have any comments before I go?
You can just back? Keep the prices down and the water running and the electricity on. I'm good.
Okay.
I had a question that you don't necessarily need to answer now, but I'd like to get a feel of. I want to commend this utility, the board, the management, and the staff for doing the things necessary over the last while to bring us a budget that's not only balanced but affords us another year of not having to have rate increases. I know the extraordinary efforts that have gone into that in terms of reductions in staffing, cutting of costs, scrubbing of capital budgets, refinancing of debt and PERS obligations, and I think this board is appreciative of yet another year of a positive outlook. I wonder, though, as I contemplate your projections and I think about how we've been successful with all of that, how I would know when we're starting to bump up against the guardrail. You know, do I start seeing that in terms of reliability statistics going south on us? Do I, you know, and so I'm trying to find a way in all of this, despite what is good news, to gauge how much sense of risk at some point we ought to begin to feel about yet another year of absorbing Bonneville. You know, I know we're not having an increase this year, but we're yet absorbing the one that we took last year. And I just, without extending the discussion tonight, as we adopt this budget, would like to have some feedback from staff as to what your sense of risk is around managing ourselves forward and the kind of indicators that we all should continue to pay attention to as some sense of when we might need to contemplate a rate adjustment, so as not to get caught by surprise.
Okay. All right. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
All right. So I heard some interest in pushing through the break since we only have one more substantive item. What's the thought of the board? Push through or have a break?
We would push through if I could just simply be afforded a cup of coffee.
Go get your coffee.
Go get a cup of coffee. Okay, we will push through while the next folks who will be talking about the quarterly strategic and operational report will be called up. I will eat my dinner afterwards.
You can eat it during their presentation.
Yeah. People get home with family time.
Yeah.
You guys have been here since like 3:45, haven't you? I had intended to be here, but things popped up at work, and so I had to.
Yeah.
I got to show you something in a presentation I gave the other day.
Okay. Rod, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Carry forth.
So, good evening, commissioners. I was feeling really good about this slide till Patrick got up and started talking about being in service for 146 years. so, I guess the thing I would like to say, though, is this is my chance to get to do the Q3 report for 2019. Although I'm doing this, I would like to acknowledge that really this is the summation of a ton of work by staff, most of who are here. And not most, but quite a few are here, and so I'd really like to acknowledge that there's been a lot of hard work this quarter. So how do we keep delivering products reliably and safely and affordably, Dick? Well, we really lean on our values, safety, reliability, responsibility, and we keep working with the community, and those are the guidelines that help us focus and on the decisions we make and the things we do and the activities. We also work with a strategic focus, and this year there are 6 goals that are lined out, and so I'm going to go through those goals and tie them to the particular values. I'd like to start with safety. So during this quarter, we continue to see our metrics for lost time and injuries below the benchmarks and averages. We were awarded the Oregon's Healthiest Employer, and we had a nice safety expo, and Sonia, I think you were there, and maybe some others, but it was a really good event, learned a lot of things, a lot of participation, We had over a 99% approval rating from employees on it, so it was very successful. It was a good day. Going to the water division, and kind of following Karen's source to tap kind of model, the source, we were clear of sanotoxins, no major problems in the McKenzie. Lots of work done there to keep it clean and modified, and or not modified, but measured. The treatment plant, again, was operating pretty efficiently. The one notable thing that happened was it had the lowest demand since 1985 in September. But as you remember, it rained quite a bit in September, so that seems to be the thing that happens. One of the deliveries, we had some main breaks that where the metrics are trending a little high. It's just something to keep an eye on and watch over time. A new metric we're working on is that 1.43% of our customers experienced outages to date. So looking at that, that's roughly 906 outages year to date. So we'll probably be working with that in the future. You'll be seeing that as more of a trend, trending type metric. Overall operations, the water department's netting, projected to net some $2.5 million. It's doing very well. The capital budget, at the time of the end of Q3, we were looking at being approximately over budget by $500,000. Talking to Wally today, it's probably going to be a little lower than that. It may even be right at around 100%. So mostly, though, that overage is due to the work that was in 2018 that carried over to the filter plant. You see some pictures of the new piping there. And then some street work we did with the city as some opportunity costs. In the electric department, our metrics are still trending over the five-year average for our SAIDI safety reliability statistics. In part because of the storm, but in a large part too, some of the we've had a number of outages throughout the summer in wires and cross arms in particular. We'll be getting some more detailed statistics from equipment types moving ahead to help us with that asset management I talked about last time. Overall, the operations is net $4.7 million compared to budget over. And most of this is due to power prices. So we had to buy a lot of expensive power at some point. And because our generation has been out of service, it was hard for us to counter sell into the market to make up some of that. The storm also contributed to that. In the capital budget, we're projecting about $4.5 million over, which is 112%. In large part, for emergent projects, such as that's a picture of a power transformer at International Paper that was being worked on. But that was one of the projects. We added a transformer there to back up one of our major loads. Other projects were some opportunity costs. We already had some work planned in the downtown network. There were some adjacent cables that took up a big chunk of money to go ahead and replace those while we're in there. Number of projects upriver to finish out the Holden Creek work and bring that up to speed up the river. Another thing that affects operations quite a bit, outside policies, legislation, that kind of thing, some of the major things that occurred in the third quarter. The Oregon PUC started exploring some wildfire mitigation based on the events happening in California. So we're keeping an eye on that and monitoring that. We're doing some of our own internal responses to that, but it may end up in a legislative kind of regulatory environment. We'll see. I think one of the most significant things, really, from my point of view, is the board directed the general manager to work together on both Springfield Utility Board and EWEB to talk about a second source on the Willamette and explore some options there. And so we're deep in the middle of that. We've had two meetings and have another one scheduled next week. So I feel like we're making some progress along those lines. I think another big thing that happened was the PERS reform passed, which has significant impacts on UEB's finances. Sue and her team will undoubtedly tell us a lot more about that in the next the year-end report. And then finally, the carbon mitigation cap and trade bill did not pass, which has and will have impacts on future legislation as well. So the goal two is our goal to install smart meters and advanced metering services. So the end of the story is that we're not going to make our projected installs, the number. But the mantra, I guess, is that we're looking for quality over quantity. In short, the system that we originally started was designed to be an opt-in model, and it was set up for about 30,000 to 35,000 meters. What we're finding is that as we've passed 40,000 meters, we don't have enough communications infrastructure in place, for one. In other words, the radio towers to receive the signals. And two, some of the software isn't quite up to speed. So we're working on both of those projects separately. So basically there's some additional scope going on there. So right now we're on track for budget, but we're still going through the process of what the extra scoping might mean, and that'll be future reports. The good news is, though, we're getting tons of positive experiences from customers. We're getting good comments. We're finding all kinds of water leaks. During the snowstorm, the meters we did have installed, for the most part, worked really well, very helpful in the outage. So we're starting to realize the benefits of the meters. Goal three is, how do we improve our customer experience? And so basically this goal is centered around programs and policies and making life easier for the customer. One of the things that we've been doing internally is going through continuous improvement training, which is, helping us figure out how to do our processes better. The graph on the right just shows the number of participants and the number of, or indicates the number of participants, but also the number of projects that are going through. But it's resulted in improvements for our collections and limited income programs. So we're starting to see some benefits from that training and those programs. One of the things that I'm particularly kind of excited about is that customer experience improvement project. So it's an effort set up by through IT, basically. It's an IT project, but not exclusively. It's including a whole lot of people and a whole lot of input. But it's initially starting to look at how do we have our customers provide self-service in the web portal, that kind of thing. Sorry, Matt, shouldn't have said web portal. Bill payment and presentation and bill redesign. Goal four, emergency response. So there's two parts to that, and the target was to install two emergency well sites this year, and we're not going to make that. We'll probably get one in, but we'll have an additional two done by the end of Q1 next year. On the electric side, we've got a draft study back from our consultants. Basically, we're trying to figure out how we can use local generation. So there's a lot of electrical studies and things that need to be looked at so we can start incorporating how we build our system out to connect those sources of generation and how we can start them. For restoration, both water and electric have been working on drills. On the left, there's a picture of our emergency trailer in Beaverton, Portland area, somewhere. Anyway, they took part in a drill up there and were very successful in their in comparison to some of our other utilities. So we just completed in electric another Blue Sky drill to get prepared for this winter. We continue to work our FEMA resiliency projects. So in 2016, we were awarded, or after the 2016 storm, we were awarded some money by FEMA to underground some projects and to harden some of the other overhead lines. So we're, I think, roughly got 10 of those done, should have all but three done by Q1 next year. That's a picture on the right of some electric service that'll be installed going to Blanton, which has been a very hazardous and frequently visited spot during storms. Goal 5 is focused on limited income folks, and so we continue to be on target with that. Disconnects are down, and write-offs are down. $600,000 in assistance has been provided. So those programs are doing very well and being very successful. Climate change, goal 6, again, right on target. Conservation's taking place through the community projects. Carbon emissions are also on target through energy efficiency, energy vehicle, electric vehicle kind of programs, fleet management. That's a nice picture of our trucks practicing carbon reduction right there in the yard. And one of the other things I wanted to touch on, and it kind of gets to what Dick was talking about a little bit, you know, we have as one of our strategic goals is resiliency and restoration. And I think often we think of resiliency as being a goal and an end point. I think there's also an argument to be made about resiliency being more of a value. And I think that I'd like to give a shout out to our finance department, as they have, and Dick did a nice job pointing this out, they've done a nice job, and the utility has done a nice job of controlling our costs. And being resilient means more than just having fancy equipment out there and earthquake-proof filter plants and those kind of things. It also means having good, solid finances. So we're working in all areas on this sort of what I call resiliency value. Because it allows you to continue to invest in infrastructure, employees, education. Actually, this both of these slides, I think, have Mindy in them. So, but rate control, billing assistance, all those kind of things. And finally, I'd just like to say I think this is a really good time to work at UWEB. If I kind of stood back and take a look at all the things that are going on, there's some really cool stuff, and there's a lot of cool stuff for everybody. And it's kind of exciting, I think, to be at this point where there's going to be some changes in our industry and moving ahead. But I just picked a few things. We're working on, I wouldn't say updating or revamping, but our safety program is moving into from a safety program to a safety, health, and wellness type, wellness kind of program. Resilience and reliability, we're looking at a second source and a lot of water system upgrades to our pump stations. Our reservoirs. Lots of looking and work that we can do on our electric system. AMS is going to provide us a wealth of information and the ability to get to a lot of products, things to offer our customers that they've never had that chance and choice before. So consolidating all the employees at the Rock is going to be really cool too. There's some really neat space. Hopefully we'll get to show you guys around when we get that done. But the dispatch room's impressive. The new call center is much larger. So IRP process, you've heard a lot about that. Again, the customer experience improvement project. Carmen Smith, that'll be wrapping up here pretty quick. That's going really super well. I was just talking to Mike about that this morning. And basically, you know, we're going to be able to again, focus on products and programs that we've never been able to offer before. So I think it's kind of a fun time to be here, and I'm happy to be here, and just thank everybody for working so hard. So questions?
Okay. Any questions? Commissioner Brown.
A comment and a question. I know that we didn't meet our target on the water for some reason. I don't know what it is, but better late than wrong. But I would want to just stress on the water emergency location. We didn't meet our second. I know that we're ahead of general schedule, but to me, that is life-saving to our community, and it's really important, and I would hope we could make that a priority. You know, if I had to choose prioritizing one thing over the other, that to me would be a very, very top priority because it saves lives, and we're setting up parts of this community to survive, and I just don't want to get caught getting delayed and have the majority, you know, we haven't gone south of the river yet, and that's where the majority of the people are, and I just hope we can get that going sooner than later. So just as a feedback. And a question about the economics. So a few years ago, we spent $150 million relicensing Leeburg and Walterville, and out of those two, Leeburg is our star of the two. It's not running. We have debt service on $100 million, whatever. We have all the staff. We have the housing and everything. How do we continue to show a positive when we have all that stranded asset and all that money that's sitting there not performing? I mean, how does that continue to play into the situation? Because that's the grill in the living room for me. Where are we going to go with that, and how are we going to address that?
Yeah. So comment number one, we lost so when Mel retired and I took over water, I think we lost some of the focus on that goal, I'll be honest, because there's no reason we couldn't have got that done. I think we just had some loss of sight on that for a bit. So, but we are working on some sites down south, and so we're making progress in that again. Number two, though, it's back to that resiliency. So how do you ride through these kind of things? Well, and Sue can tell you, I'm sure, in greater depth, but it's basically there's reserves and there's ways to – we're going to have to face that. There's some capital work to be done when whatever decision gets made moving ahead for Leeburg in particular, right? But we're set up well to deal with that through capital reserves and there's power pricing reserves. There's all kinds of stuff that they reserve money for. So,
thank you.
Okay. Just quickly, three things stuck out for me. One is that I appreciate the opportunity to evaluate the progress of our, I'll call it again, AMI project. And to a certain extent that we're in a ways and need some recalibration, I think that's a good idea rather than just forging ahead without taking the time to recalibrate. I think it's something we should continue to watch. I'm a little concerned that we will then continually be behind the curve relative to our installation completion expectations, and I'm not sure what the implications of that might be either strategically or financially, but I just think, for me, something to watch. The second thing I wanted to point to was that on some of the graphs that were in the detail, I saw a fairly large number of the outage statistics associated with equipment failures. Maybe in terms of weighted minutes of outage, and I didn't look to see exactly how those were distributed in terms of, you know, number of customers involved versus duration of outage, but that was something that poked out at me as oh wow, are we starting to have more our outages of equipment outages starting to have an impact on our reliability statistics, and does that have some connection to our continued investment in capital facilities? So I don't know that there's an answer to that, but I saw some red there, and it concerned me. And I think the third area, and then I'll let you respond, is that generally speaking, I was seeing more variability in our capital budget results than I would normally see in an annual period relative to individual projects and as a whole. And I know we have some budget amendments coming with respect to that. And I understand the conundrum around that because there's a lot of work and a lot of money and a lot of contracts to manage and all of that, and there's always a degree of variability, but you know, and I understand that we have the flexibility and we've afforded staff the flexibility to do deferrals and move stuff into future years, but you know, at some level it becomes a concern for me as to how we hold you accountable for staying within the budget and completing the work that we plan, and you know, basically making sure that we're not just pushing, you know, we don't really offset an overrun by pushing a project that's needed into the future. So I'm not expressing this very well, but I just saw a little more variability on the capital side than I normally would expect. I'm quite forgiving in that regard because I know what that involves, but, you know, it leaves me with the question of, well, given that we want you to have that flexibility, how, you know, where do we draw the line and how do we ultimately ensure that we're getting the work done that we intend to get done at a cost overall that is that's holding you accountable for a cost-effective result. But other than that, I think we've reached a point in the reporting format where it's almost too much information, and I appreciated the summary version in the presentation tonight because even though I've invited and welcomed the detail, that we're now onto like a 30-page document, and I appreciate all of the staff's participation in these presentations because it's good to see each of you up here embracing the work that we're doing.
Working backwards, the capital plan, two things I didn't mention about the capital plan. So we've had about $1 million more customer work this year, which is reimbursable, so that's factored into that. And then the FEMA reimbursement hasn't rolled in either. And the handful of those projects we would have done forward, so we're just kind of getting ahead of them. So there's some opportunity costs going on there. But what I think you'll see is as we move from the old planning and so capital budgeting and everything, as you kind of noted, there's some, it can be a five-year process from a planning perspective till things get done. And so I think what we're doing is moving into the newer, more data-driven kind of thing. And so to get to your other question about equipment failure, about a year ago we started implementing extra codes in the failure tracking we do to get more precise about the equipment that is actually failing. So we presented, I think, last time a study about cable and failure rates of cable and projected. So hopefully now we'll start gathering data that verifies that data and helps us make good decisions about cable replacement, for instance, because we know that's a huge reliability problem. Cross arms, like anecdotally, I can kind of tell you some of the things that were in that equipment, but from a planning perspective, we got to wrap all that stuff in with substations and some of the other infrastructure. So our goal is to get this five-year window and the balance, capital budgeted balanced within that five-year frame, 3 to 5. I know I can feel Sue looking at me, but... Did that answer your question?
Thank you.
I'll jump in. I too was a bit concerned. So does this $500,000? That is, that's 103% that has exceeded. It's not just 3% over the budget. It's 103%.
No. Correct? Sorry, I was just trying to illustrate that. We're at 100. We could possibly be up to 103% of our budgeted amount.
Okay. I just want to make sure because the slide is a little unclear, and so I wanted to make sure on the record it's 3% over budget, not 103% or 112%
yes.
over budget. Okay. That's much less concerning to me.
We'd be having a different conversation if we were
right. That's 100%. What. That, and I just wanted to highlight that. That was my assumption, but I just wanted to make sure that got on the record. Otherwise, I did have one point I wanted to say that I'm really excited about the loan generator program, and I'm glad that that's succeeding. So thank you for the background information on that as well. See, I mean, 59 customers, roughly upriver in an area has very low population. That actually really can mean life and death for those folks. I mean, if that had been in place during this last ice storm, that really could have, you know, made or break different conversations and put people in a much better situation. So I'm really excited that that's moving forward. I think that was the right thing to do. Other than that, appreciate your input. And I like the format. That was a really great, easy to digest format. So thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioners. That was a Rod Price special format developed just for you. So.
Right. Any... Okay. It looks like we will move on from that on to correspondence and board agendas.
Yes, commissioners, good evening. On correspondence, there were four items of correspondence. One was asking for input. That can be in our one-on-ones or email or this evening. That had to do with the downtown network connection charge. That is simply looking at a more equitable way of charging within the downtown network. It is not subsidized in or out of the downtown network. It's only looking at costs within the network. The other three items were information only. The first one had to do with a little clarification around the upcoming budget amendments. We wanted to give the board a little bit of a preview of that and not just drop that on the agenda in December. So if there were any questions, please reach out on that. One of them had to do with an update on major event and disruption planning and preparation. As Rod mentioned in his highlights, we've done some training and some drills, and we wanted to highlight that for the board in a little bit more detail. And then finally, there was an explanation, which was really related to one of the items this evening related to Pure Water Partners and how that structure works. Highlight that a little bit further. In March, we will be back with a full source protection strategic update. It's good timing. It's about 2 years into the program, and it warrants kind of a full view of what that looks like. So that's on the agenda for March. I will comment also that part of the reason that we saw financial pressure on the electric utility this year was because some of the resources we would normally plan as available, like a LEBURG, was not available. And it was not available during a period of time when wholesale prices were higher. And so that did have a financial impact on the utility. It is something that we think is very significant, and we'll be back to talk to the board about what the future looks like for LEBURG and the canal and the assessment. Some of it will be technical, some of it will be social, some of it will be environmental and economic. And so we'll try to review all of those issues with the board, and I'm estimating that will be a late spring, early summer update by the time we get all the assessments and analysis done for the board to review, and then provide guidance relative to its future. Any questions on correspondence, comments?
I have a question about the LEBURG. So are we going to also be engaging with the community up there? Is there a plan for that, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think whenever you're talking about, that's what I meant by the social side of this. Yeah. I think that we've had a presence on the McKenzie since 1911, and part of the discussion and decision will have to be outreach to the community and what our situation is. We'll have to listen to the community. It is part of the decision-making process, along with the environmental and the economic. All those things have to be considered. The board will have there's no set predetermined outcome on that. I think that we have to be really good listeners. We have to look at these assessments with an open mind and understand where it fits in our integrated resource plan as well, because that's a piece of it. And I know that the board is engaging on that, and so there's a number of elements that we need to consider. If we just ignored the community, that would not be representative of what we're about, which is a community owned utility.
Okay. Commissioner Helgeson?
I just wanted to comment on your last point about Walterville and LEBURG. I think it's difficult for us, you know, being almost a year or so into the shutdown of LEBURG, to kind of patiently wait for a conversation that we really can't have yet because we don't have enough information. And I would just invite my board peers not to prejudge what's in there or what the outcome is, because I don't think staff really has yet the information that they'll need to bring forward for us to consider when we look at that. And that's difficult because we all sit here with some sense of angst about what that could bring, or with thoughts that we carry relative to our past experiences with those projects. But I just would counsel us to sort of be as calm and collected as we can and not try to prejudge what that might mean, but prepare ourselves for whatever that conversation could look like, and certainly support the staff in their efforts to bring us as round and full a conversation around that as we can have, so that when the time comes and is right and we have the information to make decisions, that we can do that thoughtfully. And I just hear us continuing to sort of angst about that, as I do too, but knowing that we're not quite ready to solve that is kind of where I feel we are.
Yeah. Commissioner, your point's well taken. I think that we do need to gather up as much information and data as we can, also see where that fits in the other plans that we're working on. I will say that we, in the short term, have not included Leeburg in the 2020 budget, and so that is accounted for in this next year's budget, so we're not counting on any production out of it. What we don't have in any of the plans yet is any projection of capital or any impact on other economics, or relative, and I think it also is warranted to mention that FERC also plays a role in this. If anybody is not expeditious, it's FERC, and so they play a role in this decision as well. So it's a regulatory decision, it's a social decision, and it's an economic one, and we need to be really thorough in the information that we gather to help the board guide us on that decision. Didn't have anything else. The agenda report, I think, is fairly clear. There's the only thing that I wanted to mention specifically was the March meeting. We will also have some follow-ups on integrated resource planning in the spring with the board. Also, I'm reaching out, and will be reaching out to Bonneville to see at some point if the administrator of the Bonneville Power Administration can come down and give the board a presentation on Bonneville's strategy and where they're headed. I think that would be a good opportunity for both the board and the public to hear what Bonneville's direction is relative to some of the issues that you hear about with markets, the Columbia River system operation, and the environmental impact statement. The preliminary report is due out in February. That will then go through a public comment period and eventually end up in a record of decision from Bonneville and the other action agencies, which would be the Corps and the Bureau of Reclamation, in the fall. And so that's an item that can have significant impact on financial impact on Bonneville and therefore EWEB. And so there's a lot of things that are happening in the industry over the next 6 months to a year that impact our power supply. And so the integrated resource plan is coming at a good time.
Okay, I think that we are finished with that agenda item. We will move on to board wrap up. Any comments? Okay, we'll start down here at Commissioner Schloss.
One thing really quickly I wanted to add was about the IARP. And I really appreciated the formats that we had last month, where we kind of started off that process, where we were paired up with another commissioner or individually and met in a small group. That worked really well for me. I think for other commissioners too, and I just appreciated kind of the presentation, but also the informal conversation that we were able to have. So, thank you.
I too appreciated those briefings. Had mine the other day. My takeaway from that was that there's some strategic context in which some of the questions that the IRP is designed to engage get positioned, and that has to do with things like, how is the market going to evolve, and what is the role of utilities going to be going forward relative to power supply and obligation to serve, and some things that relate more actually to our strategic planning as to envisioning in the longer run who we are and how we're positioned to continue continue to serve our mission. So that probably gets us off into woo land pretty quickly, but I'm just mindful of the fact that some of the questions about how much load and what to do about, you know, electric vehicles kind of get answered in the context of how the industry progresses and what our business model looks like, and, you know, larger questions than I see us currently able to engage. The only other thing I wanted to ask about was I did find the portion of the consent calendar item that I was curious about some clarification on. If I could just note it here, maybe you could capture that in your list of follow-up items. But on the agreement and the contract with DEQ for oversight of the mitigation work at the coal gas site, there under purchasing process on page 2 of the consent item, there's a reference to $50,000 adjustment to the ongoing services, and that amount was not presented to the board as an exemption for board approval under a cited provision of our contracting rules having to do with required fees and that sort of stuff. And not necessarily now, because I know that my peers are tiring of my engagement here, but maybe as part of the follow-up report, you could just clarify for me what that piece was that you were alluding to, so that I'm remembering the board policy exemption and how it applied in this instance. I didn't have a concern about the item or whatever had happened there, but I just didn't remember exactly what that rule was. So,
yeah, so I basically quoted the rule here in this paragraph, but I can provide, you know, I think it's in our EL2, you know, the board policy around what they approve is what that's
partly
quoting
my
from.
Thought was that you alluded yourself to some lack of certainty around exactly how that provision might apply to this, so you were bringing it to us just in case. So, I mean, if there's any confusion about what that rule would require in that instance, I would hope that would get cleared up and we'd all be on the same page. Thanks. Okay.
All right, I had two quick items. One, I failed to acknowledge that Commissioner Mattel is absent, and it was an excused absence, so I should have mentioned that at the beginning. I failed to do that. Obviously, he's not here. Secondly, I'm meeting with the Springfield Utility Board Chair, John DeWinter. We've been meeting quarterly, so we'll be meeting in a couple of weeks, and so to continue building that relationship with them as well.
So I've been apparently totally misinformed about College Hill, and the neighbors are either taking me to the woodshed or I don't know what's going to happen, but they want to have a meeting with me and find out what's happening, because I thought we were selling it, and it's my understanding we're not, at least the majority of it. And then the construction could be very disruptive. I mean, blasting and all those things, a long construction period. So can you get me a fact sheet so when I sit down with them, I can speak with a little bit of knowledge so I don't get totally pummeled? But they just want me to ask and tell them what's going on. And I said, sure, I'll just as soon as I find out, because I had a total misconception of what's going on.
Yeah, and it's a little bit premature given that we haven't started our public outreach. Or
yeah, I know,
and
but they've been asking me these points.
We'll keep you safe in the woodshed, maybe. we'll see.
This is your opportunity to get rid of me. I mean, I may not come back.
Yeah, we'll get you some information on that.
All right.
Well, I think part of that strategy involves construction of another low-level reservoir in a different location, so there are other outreach issues associated with that that begin to tether themselves to what you would talk about there, and so let's not start that in earnest until we're ready.
I'm actually taking a tour of the various sites and design ideas tomorrow, along with Rod Price, so it'll be very timely, and we'll try to get you the best facts we can. What'd you say? If they run you out of town, just jump in front and act like it's a parade?
Yeah, if you're getting run out of town, jump in front and call it a parade.
I think we are living in an environment in which you can actually refer a term as best facts. I thought the facts were just the facts, whether they were the best or not, but it seems like we're in an environment where you get to choose your facts, and I guess I would agree with you. If we get to do that, let's choose the best ones.
Okay. I have no comment on that.
With that, let's adjourn.
Thank you, Commissioners. Adjourn.